Well, thank you, Mr. Randall, and I'd like to greet all of you. It is nice to be here in person. It's good that we can listen from home. And to any online who are listening in, I certainly extend a welcome to you as well and hope you are having a good day. And I appreciated the sermon that we heard from Mr. Hoffert as well. It is certainly appropriate for this time of year and for this season, this year in general that we're going through. Well, we don't need to be reminded that this year has been very special, not in a good way either. We don't need to be reminded that throughout the state, the nation, and the world, people are feeling much stress, worry, fear, and anxiety. It has hit certain individuals and families very hard. It may be even more troubling to recognize that during the end times of tribulation, those who are alive then may look back on these times as the good old days. So maybe we should be more appreciative for what we do have. This may be looked back upon as being normal at some point. That doesn't give us too much encouragement, does it? But because we live in the present, and we have to deal with our present situations, whatever they may be. Well, today's world and situations bring much cause for worry and fear and anxiety, or at least they can bring those emotions about. So in this message, I'm going to consider the emotion of fear by breaking it down into a few categories to help us to understand how to deal with it, how to cope with it. And the title I've given this message is, What Are We Afraid Of? What are we afraid of? Now, to help understand fear, I searched online for types of fears, and I expected to get a simple, generic list of maybe the 10 most common fears people have or something, but instead, I saw a lot of different lists. The 10 most common fears, the 7 fears, the 5 fears, lists of phobias and other results. And included in those examples, I certainly didn't look at all of them, but just scanned through a few of them for thoughts. I saw several of the fears that we might expect to see, such as fear of flying, we've heard of that, or claustrophobia, or agoraphobia, that's the fear of open spaces, acrophobia, the fear of heights. Those were all pretty common and things I would expect to see there, but there were many other fears mentioned, such as fear of snakes or dogs or insects or storms or so on. And you can find a list of over 100 specific types of fears. So if you're looking for things to worry about or be afraid of, you can look online and find something that is going to bother you. But I won't go into detail because I don't want any of us to recognize things that we didn't know we were supposed to be afraid of. So kind of ignore that. But there's one phobia listed that kind of caught my eye. It was something I'd never heard of. And in a way, it's a rather ironic one. Have you ever heard of hippopotamonstrosesquipedaliophobia? Anyone? But I didn't think so. The word itself is 35 letters long. And anyone who suffers from it would likely never be able to use that word to describe their condition, because this strange word is the name given to the fear of long words. Now, I have a feeling that maybe I was taken in by a hoax. You never know, but I bet anyway. All of these lists describing so many different fears gave me too much information for this message. So I was hoping for a more simple and generic way to break them down. I didn't really capture that, so I will consider my own categories. I have 4 categories of fears that I'm going to talk about. The first one is fear of the unknown, just very general. The second one is fear of the known. The third is fear of failure. And fourth, I call it fear of the what ifs. And I'll go into each of these in this message. And then after that, I'll give some examples of things that God tells us not to fear and the encouraging promises that he makes to help and protect us. So what are we afraid of? Number one, a lot of times the simple answer to this is the unknown. Fear of the unknown. We're afraid of the unknown because by definition we don't know what it might be or how to deal with it. Now I'll give you a personal example about it. This was from my childhood. I was about 8 years old. My sister was 11 or 12. My brother was 4. The three of us were at home alone because our parents had gone out for the afternoon. Now, we lived in an older house in Anoka at that time. That was when we had first moved to town. The three of us were in a back room playing games or working a puzzle or doing something to pass the afternoon away. It was a very dreary day. I am thinking it must have been probably October, maybe a little earlier in the season than we are in right now, when you get these dreary, rainy days. And that day there was some rain. It was kind of dark out. We could hear the sound of the wind blowing through the trees. But then sitting there, we heard another sound that was different and closer. And it was like a scratching sound on the wall. We had no idea what that could be. At first, we just shrugged it off, thinking that it must have just been a broken branch or something like that that was scraping against the house. Now, this was an outside wall of the house. But then we heard it again, and it sounded a little louder and more persistent. Now, because of the dark weather, the room was pretty dimly lit. We couldn't see too well in there. And these walls were covered with wallpaper. We stared at the wall where the sound seemed to be coming from. And then suddenly the wallpaper ripped. There was just a hole that appeared on the wallpaper. And then something poked right through the wall at us. We all screamed. We were scared. We didn't know what to expect from it. And we just hoped that our parents would get back home soon. To me, it looked like the front of some kind of gun was poking through the wall. But we had no idea. We couldn't explain it at that time, and we were very frightened by it. So I'm going to leave that story at that point for now, just to keep you wondering about what that might have been and to maybe give you a little feeling about how we were thinking at the time and what we were wondering. It was fear of the unknown. Now, what are the effects of fearing the unknown? For one thing, our minds tend to look at the worst possible explanation and outcome. I don't know what that is about us, but we always think, oh, something bad is going to happen. There are always many ways a situation can turn out, and some of them might actually be very good. Sometimes the immediate result might be very hard to endure, but it ends in positive ways that we could never have imagined. We just fear what we don't know until we come to understand what it is. We find a lot of examples in the Bible about this, especially when you consider the Israelites leaving Egypt. Now, early Israel complained a lot. We know that. They were eager and excited to leave Egypt, but this excitement changed to fear afterwards and dread when they started to face obstacles. I'm going to read the first four verses of Exodus 16, Exodus 16, 1 through 4, where the Israelites were worrying about food, what they were going to eat, and started thinking about how good they had it back in Egypt. Exodus 16, 1. And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. Then the whole congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the pots of meat. They start thinking about food. And when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out of this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. They were concerned about that and started thinking about some of the good things. Egypt was bad, but at least they weren't starving. The Israelites didn't know what they would be able to find for food, but God knew their needs. God knows our needs too. And he provided manna and quails for them. So they should have been happy. And they were for a little while, sort of. Later on, Moses was up on Mount Sinai, and he was up there far longer than the Israelites expected him to be. So they took matters into their own hands, and they began to fear and were turning away from God. And this is the episode of the golden calf. In verse 7 of Exodus 32, I'll read verse 7 through 10. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go, get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.'" They were replacing God with an old familiar permanent God figure that they could see. And the Lord said to Moses, "I have seen this people, and indeed it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and I may consume them. And I will make of you a great nation." God was ready to give up on the entire nation of Israel and just start over with Moses. That's how bad things were. But Moses persuaded God to show them mercy and not destroy them. And it's fortunate for them and for all of us that that happened. If left to themselves, the Israelites would gladly have returned to Egypt. On their own, they were afraid of what might happen to them. Now, Moses had his share of concerns, too. Of course, we'll go into that a little later in one of the other categories. But that's the first category. Fear of the unknown. The second one is the opposite of that. The opposite of fear of the unknown could be considered to be fear of the known. And in this case, we might be afraid because we do know what the consequences might be for certain actions. We know quite certainly what will happen and know that it may be unpleasant. But we also know that it's something that we need to do regardless. It might be, especially when we're younger, we know that we've done something that we're going to be punished for, and we kind of hate to go home and face our parents because we know what's going to happen. But otherwise, there may be dreaded tasks that we know must be done. Just something that's hard to do. We've done it before. It might be back-breaking or hard mentally or whatever. We know how hard it is. We know how tough it'll be to do it. But we also know that it has to be done. So we have kind of a fear of it in that regard. Now, a common example of this, or at least it used to be in older times, is a fear of going to the dentist. Now, maybe all of us have been through that. I know I certainly never looked forward to it when I was younger, but I knew that it wouldn't take all that long. My paternal grandfather, that's my dad's father, he refused to go to a dentist. And I don't fully know the reasons behind that, but I know that as far back as I can remember, he had only a few teeth left in his mouth. I know he had one in the front there and maybe a few in the back, but he had lost most of them because he didn't take care of them, and he didn't want to go to the dentist or refused to go. And even all the pictures I have of him, it's not that many, maybe 50 or so, But every one of them, even going back to his early years, show him with his mouth closed. He would never smile and show his teeth. I'm sure he must have been very self-conscious about it, but that's the path he chose. And then you can consider, on his side anyway, that he might have had good reason to dread the dentist, because that would have been 100 years ago. And dental practices then were much more painful than they are today. Now, like most of you, I've had my share of dental work done. I've had crowns and root canals and abscesses and other problems, but it's really far less painful today than it was even when I was in grade school. They had Novocaine back then, but that compared to today's methods, that took a little while for it to set in. And now it doesn't take all that long for the painkillers, the anesthetics to set in. And it isn't really all that painful or that long a process to go through. But back then, back in my grandfather's day, it would have been long and it would have been painful. And so it's fair to say he had good reason to fear going to the dentist or to refuse to go. So sometimes we just dread what we know is going to happen. Now, Job is a good example. In his many trials and sufferings, he knew what it was like to expect the worst and to then have that come upon him. And we can look at a statement he made in Job 3. It's verses 25 and 26. Job 3, 25, 26, where he says, "For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, for trouble comes." He knew or had a good idea of what was coming, and he certainly didn't look forward to it. Now, sometimes life just gives us difficult choices, and we know, or at least we have a good idea of what the result may be if we do what we know we should, and it likely will be much harder to make that right choice than to do nothing. And unfortunately, a lot of times, if we know what the outcome is going to be, we can just say to ourselves, well, if I don't do anything, then what's the harm? And sometimes there isn't, but a lot of times you're missing out on something. An example of fear of the known might be quitting a job to go back to school for more education and experience. The expense of school and the lack of income or decrease in income will make things a lot harder for the immediate future. And we know that it will be difficult if we decide to do it, but it will be far better for us in the long run if we can look beyond that point of depriving ourselves a little bit. It will more than pay for itself afterwards. And so we generally choose to make that choice, just knowing, even knowing what's going to come of it. So that was the second category of fear of the known. The third one is fear of failure. Has anyone in here never failed at anything? I think I see all the hands I'm going to see on that. It's very common. We all go through it, and it's not fun to fail. It can be very humbling. And it causes us to take a deeper look into our own character and our goals in life. One example in my own life was when I got a near-failing grade in college in one of the math courses that I was taking. It was especially discouraging because I hadn't had any problem with the courses up to then. And, of course, my parents weren't too happy about that, to pay for a class that I wasn't going to get credit for it. But for the first time in my life, I started to have doubts about whether I was heading into the right field. Maybe I'd made the wrong choice. But I knew that I couldn't just stop. I couldn't give up and say, oh, no, it's not for me. I'm going to quit it and do something else. That wouldn't happen. So I retook that same class the next time it was offered. and it was instructed by a different professor. Now, partly because of my own resolve to do better, and partly because of his different teaching style, which I was much more able to understand and follow than the other instructor I had, my results were significantly better. And I had learned in part because of my fear of failure. I knew that I had to get through this class this time. I couldn't let it stop me. Failure is a common and almost necessary experience in anything worthwhile. The key is to recognize and accept it as a stepping stone along the way and to learn from it. It just happens all the time. We see failure whenever a child is learning to walk. And in fact, last week, I think the family is here today too. I don't spot them, but I saw them come in. Last week, we noticed how proud and happy a small boy was to be walking. We could see him running in the back there and just eager to take step after step. How many times did he fall before that? What if he had quit the first time that happened? Each of us went through that same experience, but we got through it because our parents encouraged us and we kept trying. And you could just see the look on his face, how happy he was and how proud both he and his parents were of him, just being able to learn how to walk. We think of Thomas Edison as one of the most successful inventors of all time. But he made many mistakes and had many failures. And the most commonly cited example of this is the number of attempts it took him to make a working light bulb. Now, we don't know for sure how many attempts it took, but so people come up with some number. There was an article in Smithsonian Magazine, and online I saw it at smithsonianmag.com, dated 11/20/2013, so almost 7 years exactly to the date today. But that article commented on Edison's many failed attempts. I'm quoting, they say, "But the man also stumbled sometimes tremendously." In response to a question about his missteps, Edison once said, "I have not failed 10,000 times. I have successfully found 10,000 ways that will not work." And that's a good way to look at it, because he learned something from every one of these failures. Now, there's a slightly different version of this quoted in a website about failing that was provided by the University of Kentucky. They talk about Thomas Edison as well in that article. And again, quoting, they say, "Thomas Edison's teacher said he was too stupid to learn anything. He was fired from his first two jobs for being non-productive. As an inventor, Edison made 1,000 unsuccessful attempts at inventing the light bulb." So they call it 1,000. The other article said 10,000. We just know it was many, many times. When a reporter asked, "How did it feel to fail 1,000 times?" Edison replied, "I didn't fail 1,000 times. The light bulb was an invention with 1,000 steps." Another way to look at it. Each of these was a stepping stone to get to the right answer. Now, a lot of times we can see examples, if we're thinking about a certain problem, or maybe like those of us who are speakers think about the topic we're going to be writing on, we have it in our mind and we sometimes see examples that apply that where we don't expect to find them. And that happens because your mind is focused on it and you automatically make associations that you wouldn't otherwise. Now, I found another example of dealing with failure in what to me was a very unexpected place. And while I was working on this message, I happened to remember something that I had seen on YouTube, and I wanted to send a link of it to a friend of mine. Many of us have probably played with dominoes at some point in our lives. And besides playing an actual game, we'd often place them upright and make a row of them, one after the other, and then watch the whole row fall down when we push the first piece. Of course, that was more fun than playing the game, I think, especially if you had a kind of large number of dominoes. Looking online, there is a woman by the name of Lily Hevish, or Hevish, who is a domino artist. I'd never heard of that, but a domino artist, and she sets up domino displays professionally for entertainment or advertising for various companies or corporate events. I didn't even consider that there was such a profession as this, but I saw that she is the most popular domino artist on YouTube. Now you think, well, how many of them can there be? So she has, what, 1,000 followers? No, she had more than that. She is the most popular domino artist on YouTube with 2 million subscribers, 2 million people that just want to know what she's doing. And she has 500 million views. 500 million, yeah, 500 million. Her job is to set up large domino displays and then knock them down. What a fun job. I don't know. And that's her full-time job. She travels around the world to do it. She has taken a break from college to work on her career. Now, the displays that she sets up, maybe you've seen some of them, they're very complex, and they can involve tens of thousands of dominoes. And some of the dominoes are red or green or blue or white or whatever color they may need for the display that they're doing. And she's very aware during setup, and this setup can take her and her team more than a day to do, spending all day just setting it up. She's very aware that a single careless motion could be disastrous for her and her team of builders. There are two main ways that a domino structure can fail. One way is a connection misses and the fall stops. So if it's only halfway through and then stops, it's a failure. And the other way is accidents. Now, to minimize the chances of failure, she puts in temporary safety gaps by taking out a few dominoes at certain points so that if the display does start coming down, it will stop at that point because she's made a gap in there. And then during the final setup, all the dominoes that were removed will be put back in. She made a statement that in the site I was looking at, gave some advice that came from an unexpected place, but it can apply to us too. She says, as a domino builder, you have to learn to get through fails. Just try to figure out what failed, how to improve it, and get better. That's good advice for domino artists, and it's good advice for us in life itself. And I'll repeat that. Just try to figure out what failed, how to improve it, and get better. In other words, learn from your mistakes. Learn how to prevent them or to make them better. Now, in the Bible, we can find many examples of people who failed but later overcame that failure. And some probably come to your mind right away. David is a good example of this. Consider the situation with David, Bathsheba, and Uriah. David committed adultery with Bathsheba and arranged to have her husband Uriah murdered. When David was confronted by the prophet Nathan, he repented, he confessed his sin, and he did lose the son born to Bathsheba. But this is covered in 2 Samuel 11 and 12, and we won't turn to that. I think most of us are familiar with that example. That's in 2 Samuel 11 and 12. Elijah, we think of him as being this great prophet, and he certainly was, but he felt like a failure. When Jezebel vowed to see him dead, Elijah fled into the wilderness, feeling all alone and deserted. He was just burned out. God finally reassured him when he spoke to Elijah in a still, small voice. I'm sure we remember that phrase, a still, small voice, how God spoke to Elijah. That's covered in 1 Kings 19, if you would like to go back and look that up. 1 Kings 19. A third example was Paul. Let me go to my notes rather than try to paraphrase it. Paul's mission earlier in life was to destroy the early Christian church. And it was only later on that he realized how wrong he had been. And we can read of his repentance in 1 Timothy 1, verses 15 and 16. 1 Timothy 1, 15 and 16 say, "This is a faithful saying and worthy of all acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am chief." He regarded himself as the worst of all sinners because he had not only not been Christian, but he had actually persecuted the early Christian church. But he goes on in verse 16 to say, "However, for this reason I obtained mercy, that in me first Jesus Christ might show all long-suffering as a pattern to those who are going to believe on him for everlasting life." Paul knew that in times to come, others could look back on the example of Paul and consider that none of them were as bad as Paul had been. And I think all of us can say none of us are as bad as Paul had been in his early life. So we can use Paul as an example of overcoming any problems that we have. And then consider Peter, how he denied Christ three times. Jesus predicted that this would happen. Peter, of course, didn't believe it. But Jesus predicted that Peter would deny him three times before the cock crows. And this happened. It's mentioned in all four of the apostles, the apostles. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all cover it near the end of the books. So that was the third thing. Fear of failure. The fourth category, called fear of the what ifs. Fear of the what ifs. There are so many things that could go wrong. So this is the fear of everything that could possibly go wrong. Especially earlier in life, I experienced this most often while traveling, because I knew I was somewhat vulnerable being by myself in a foreign country. And I worried, I feared, what about if this happens? What if I miss my connecting flight? What if I don't find my ride from the airport to the hotel? What if I can't find a hotel? What if my luggage is missing or it breaks? What if I get sick or have some kind of accident? And if you allow yourself, you can just dig yourself into a deep pit of everything possible that could go wrong. In reality, most of those things never happen, not to the extreme you imagine them. And in my case, things always worked out, and often in ways I couldn't have expected. In one example, I call this the helpful train conductor. This was many years ago. I was traveling in Europe, very young and naive, as I recognize now, looking back on myself. But I was traveling by a rail pass to wherever I felt I'm going. It was good throughout all of Western Europe. I just assumed that I'd be able to find a hotel and a way to get there. I didn't have any predetermined daily destinations or places to stay lined up. In one instance, I arrived at a city in northern Germany around midnight or thereafter, and I don't remember which city this was. It could have been Hamburg or someplace else. But when we got there, that was the end of the line for the train, for that particular route anyway. And the conductor and I were two of the few people left on the train. So we were getting off the train. It was late at night. As I said, it was midnight or later. And he asked me where I was staying. Well, I told him, well, I'll just find a taxi and ask the driver to take me to a hotel. But the conductor said, well, you won't find a taxi or a hotel at this time of night. So he said, come with me. He said to come with him, and he'd help me find one. So he drove me to a hotel where he had to knock on the door only to find that they had no rooms. So I think he woke the hotel keeper up, but just to find that they didn't have vacancies. So he drove around to one or two others doing the same thing until he found one that could take me in for the night. So I was so appreciative, very appreciative of his service. But he wouldn't take anything but thanks for it. He wouldn't accept any payment from me for it. He was just doing it because he saw a need that I had, and he knew that he could do a good thing by filling that need. That was one example. Another example I call two helpful ladies. Something similar. It was another situation, and I think this was in Durham in northern England. I had a hotel reservation, and again, I assumed that I could just take a taxi to it or walk to it. When we arrived at the train station in the afternoon, I asked two local ladies who had been on the train if they could tell me where to catch a taxi. And they said, they asked where I needed to go. And I told them I had the name of the hotel and the address. So I told them where it was. And when I told them, they said, oh, that's too far for you to walk. But you don't need to find a taxi. We'll take you to your hotel. So they did. They told me to come to them in their car. I got in, and they drove me right to my hotel. And it was a good thing that they did that, because the way to the hotel was uphill almost all the way, almost straight up a steep hill. But again, they wouldn't accept and didn't expect any kind of payment for it. Just the thanks was all they wanted, and knowing that they had done something to help with someone. So that was generally true at all the experiences I had, that it worked out, and sometimes in ways better than or different than I had expected. Any other what if situation I ran into worked out, and as long as I had considered the possibility and somewhat planned what I might do if something happened, things worked out okay. So one final hotel example. I had planned to stay in a certain small town in Germany, and I don't remember which town this was, but it was a small town that I especially wanted to see because it was a very scenic place. But when I got there, they told me that there were no hotels in that town, that I needed to go to a larger neighboring town instead. And I think that they even phoned ahead and made a reservation for me just so I could just take the train to the next town and go there. I hadn't planned to go to that other town at all, but when I got there, I found it to be very enjoyable and very picturesque. It was a spot that I saw and enjoyed, and I otherwise would have completely missed out on it. So again, things worked out. But I want to issue a caution here to add that these previous examples happened decades ago. And while there are still many helpful and well-meaning people in the world, I think I'd be quite a bit more hesitant to try things like this today. Today I like to have things all planned out and know where I'm going to be when and how I'm going to get there and have a piece of paper in my hand or on my phone or whatever that says, yeah, I have a reservation here. But regardless, what-if situations will always arise. But as long as we consider them and have at least a potential plan or a worst-case plan, things generally work out. Now, I said I'd mention Moses in another category, and this is a place where Moses might fit in. If we consider Exodus 3, when God called Moses to lead the people out of Egypt, and look at all the excuses he had. In Exodus 3, verse 10, God calls Moses by saying, "Come now, therefore, and I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." This was God's plan, and God was going to make it happen. Moses didn't know that it was going to happen no matter what. So Moses tried to wiggle his way out of it. But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" In effect, he's saying, "No, I'm not your man for this. Go ask someone else, not me." God has a response to him. And in verse 13, then Moses said to God, "Indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they say to me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" God again gives him an answer. And then going on in Exodus 4, the next chapter, verse 1. Then Moses answered and said, "But suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice." Another excuse. It's like Moses had considered every possible excuse he could think of to get out of doing this. And finally, in verse 10 of Exodus 4, he just comes right to the point and says, and Moses said to the Lord, "Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." And he knows at this point, I think, that God is not going to give up, because God has an answer for everything. In this case, he said, "Well, then Aaron can be your spokesman." And that's the way it worked out. Well, God knows the situation of every one of us, and he will never ignore us or lose his love for any one of us. He's completely aware of all the challenges that we face. The Bible includes many situations of healing and concern. We can think of Gideon and Moses and Hezekiah and Caleb and Adam, King Saul, Paul, Jonah. And throughout the Old and New Testaments, God's involved. God takes care of us during all types of fears, during all types of situations, no matter what if, what kind of a what if we can imagine. God knows, and he will help us. Now, after going through those four types or examples of fear, we need to recognize that it's normal to be afraid at times, and it happens to everyone. It's a very common thing. God is aware of this. He also tells us that there are many things that we should not fear. So he gives us answers, but he gives us preventive measures as well. Psalms is a good place to read some of these things, and I'll just read selected verses. Psalm 23 and verse 4, probably we all know this. Psalm 23 and 4, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me." So God is with us always. He brings us comfort. He brings his presence. He saves us. He prevents us, prevents the need for fear. Psalm 56, 11 is another example. Psalm 56, 11 says, "In God I put my trust. I have put my trust. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me?" So David is saying, I don't have to be afraid of anything man can do. God, I trust in God, and I won't be afraid. Psalm 27, the first three verses. Psalm 27, verses 1 through 3. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? With God with us, we have no reason to fear or be afraid. I mean, it may be a bad situation, but we can still know that God is with us and will help us. Verse 2, when the wicked came against me to eat up my flesh, my enemies and foes, they stumbled and fell. Verse 3, though an army may encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. The war may rise against me, in this case I will be confident. Now, I believe in God, I know he is with me, but still, I think if I saw an army encamped against me, I wouldn't be able to honestly say my heart shall not fear. I would feel that fear, definitely. But still, I would know that this seems impossible to me, but if it's God's will, he will bring me through it. And that's the way we have to look at anything. The war may rise against me, in this I will be confident. In Matthew 6 and 34, therefore do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. Now, this isn't saying that we don't have to think about tomorrow and make some kind of plans for what we are going to do tomorrow. Doesn't just mean sit back and not do nothing, and to do nothing, not think about it at all, but to know that we don't have to worry about it because God is with us. And the first thing is for us to get through this day. In Matthew 10, verses 28 and 31, Matthew 10, 28 through 31, and do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul, but rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a copper coin, and not one of them falls to the ground apart from your Father's will? But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. And we could just look at the birds flying through the air, seemingly carefree, and yet knowing that they face their obstacles. But God's aware of that. He will protect them as need be. He takes care of them. And even more so, he watches over each of us. He knows about us. He knows what we're going through. And we are of more value than many sparrows. Romans 8, 38 and 39. Romans 8, 38 and 39. For I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other created thing shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. That's hard to even imagine, how strong and powerful this love is that God has for us. We can't duplicate it in extending love to others. We can't come close to the love that God shows us. A couple more examples in 1 Peter 5, verses 6 and 7. 1 Peter 5, 6 and 7. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. God is willing to accept our burdens, to help us through them. And 1 John 4, verse 18 says, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who fears has not been made perfect in love. We love him because he first loved us. So we've talked about four different categories of fear: fear of the unknown, and fear of the known, fear of failure, fear of the what-ifs. And those are just broad categories, but it gives us an idea of how God is going to help us through problems, no matter what they are. Now, at the beginning of the message, are you still thinking about that? Great, great. I told you about an incident from my childhood in which the wall of the room seemed to be punctured from the outside. I and my brother and sister spent a terrifying amount of time. In reality, it was probably less than an hour, but it certainly seemed much longer than that. Just waiting for our parents to return. When they finally came into the house, we all ran to them, and we were all talking at once in our fearful excitement and telling them what happened. And I remember saying, it was round and black and had two holes in it. It was something poking through the wall at us. My parents took their coats off and came into the room where it happened. And indeed, there was a spot where the wallpaper had been torn through. You could see it. There was a rip right through it. My dad went over to it, and he pushed on the paper there, and he found a hollow spot in the wall behind it. Now, we kids didn't realize that there was an outside chimney against this wall. And at one point, previous tenants must have had a pot-bellied stove or something similar standing there with a pipe going from the stove up along the wall and out through the chimney, into the chimney for exhaust. The stove was no longer there, and when the room had been repapered, the paper hangers neglected to put anything in that spot to block the hole. So my dad pushed the hole open, just kind of pushed the paper out just to see what was there. And he shone a flashlight up the chimney, and that frightened an animal. We think it was possibly a raccoon that had sought some shelter from the rain and wind and perhaps got a little warmth in the chimney. And it was this animal's claws that had ripped the wallpaper. There was a little kind of flat spot there where he could sit on to do this. So his claws had ripped the paper, and its nose is what had poked through the wall. Now, like I said, it was round and black. It had two holes in it. Yeah, that could be a raccoon's nose. So my dad blocked that opening with a round metal plug just made for that purpose, and the problem and the mystery were solved. Now, our fear at the time was very rational because the cause was unknown. We had no explanation for it. But from that point on, it just became a humorous bit of folklore in the family. Now, we've seen in this message that there can be many categories or types of fear in our lives. And I mentioned four general areas: fear of the unknown, fear of the known, fear of failure, and fear of the what-ifs. God has also assured us that there are many things we do not need to fear or worry about because he will be with us and will take care of us. God is always in charge and is with us in whatever situation we may face. So I'll close with Isaiah 41, verse 10. Isaiah 41, verse 10 says, "Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand."